What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Dr. Irina Scott returns to discuss her latest book, Aliens and the Apocalypse, and ponders if the messages some claim to receive are already hardwired into our DNA. With drones flying across several countries' airspace, and humanity seemingly on a path of self-destruction, have we always had the answer inside of ourselves? But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patron, Michael, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. Thank you very much. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and updates. Our exclusive merchandise store is available via TeePublic, and you can find the link for that in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Is human destiny always connected to the survival of the fittest? Or is cooperation the real secret of evolution and our survival? On today's show, I'm delighted to extend a warm welcome back to Dr. Irina Scott. In her latest book, Aliens and the Apocalypse, The Meaning of Alien Messages, Dr. Scott postulates on the endearing theories of the end times that seem to precede all cultures and the removal of certain female roles in our history in this. As civilization speeds towards even more complex ways to kill each other, has humanity finally hit its tipping point? Dr. Scott, as I was joking earlier before we started the interview, I can't believe it's been 3 years. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be back.
I think it's one of those things now, Irina, that we're in a situation that a lot of us have got to know each other so well, and we're all friends on social media. So often, when you do this show, you don't realise how long it is since you've had an actual conversation with someone, because as I was joking earlier, I'm always enjoying your wildlife photography from your home in the area, and what wonderful creatures you've caught. So I always feel like we've spoken fairly regularly, but like I say, it's almost exactly 3 years since we had a proper conversation.
It seems a lot shorter than that.
It does indeed. It does indeed. And obviously always keeping abreast with your wonderful work alongside our mutual friend, Philip. I mean, the last time we spoke, before we dive into your latest book, there was a lot of things coming forward in regards to Pascagoula. Obviously, a lot's changed since then. We've sadly lost Calvin last year. It seems to be one of those cases now that 10 years ago, I think we weren't very convinced there was much more to discover. And I think what we've learned even in the last 5 years, Irina, has been remarkable. And you've been knee deep in all this new evidence and interviews that have been happening over the last couple of years, haven't you?
It's just amazing how much material there was. And Philip keeps asking and asking, and just a vast amount of material that keeps coming up brand new. So we're really happy. I mean, it's a lot to go through, but it's just amazing how much material there you can find. People have had it stored away and nobody paid attention to it, and they dig around and find it.
Well, it's certainly to our benefit, isn't it? It's one of those things, I think, sometimes when you have a case and you think, well, we know as much as we have, and Pascagoula is one of the best known cases, I think, primarily because we've got audio recordings, We've had numerous witnesses come forwards in the intervening years. Calvin kind of took control of the story again in the latter part of his life. Yourself and Philip have really helped sort of connect a lot of dots. We've discovered that there's a lot more that was going on either side of Pascagoula. Even with your experience, Irina, are you amazed at what keeps getting discovered? Because it just seems that there doesn't seem to be an end to any of these materials that keep coming forward. Every time I see something, I'm like, who's been sat on that for 45 years?
Yeah, I've been totally amazed because people stored away that information and it sort of became dormant, but it was still there. And when they go back and, you know, find people, ufologists and stuff are turning information into big centers. When they do, well, there's Pascagoula and brand new information. I mean, we've been finding information from the interviews right after it happened and things like that that we didn't know about.
I suppose when it comes to Pascagoula, I think one of the things is we've now got so many additional witnesses who also saw strange things on that particular night. We've had other researchers who have uncovered incredible evidence. It makes you wonder, really, are we going to stumble across something even more special than what we've got? Because I know Philip's done the transcripts of the hypnosis sessions. The new book that's due out next year, I think, that Philip's written and you've done the foreword for, Irina, which is, I think, is called Pascagoula Uncovered, I believe, has even more new information included. Do you think this is a unique case in the fact that we've got so much new material that keeps getting released? Or do you think this is one of those cases that because people have really looked into it, we've begun to find things, and there are other cases of a similar nature that the evidence to clarify what happened and what was going on just needs to be discovered for some of those as well?
I think both. It was pretty unique, though, because a lot of abduction stories, they seem to be of people that are out in the boondocks or whatever you call them in England, out, you know, in the country someplace with no witnesses, and somebody just scoops in and abducts somebody that's nowhere. And with this, it was near a town, and there were a lot of witnesses that saw something weird and reported it. I mean, it was strange enough that they actually went to the police and reported it. And so I think that's pretty unusual. And a lot of the abduction cases, nobody knows anything happened. And then they'll, years later, they'll think, well, there's missing time. And then maybe later look into it. But this was unusual because Charles Hickson decided to report it immediately. And nobody does. I mean, if I had a sighting, I wouldn't report it immediately because if I was wrong, everybody, you know, tell me I was crazy.
Yes.
But he was brave, and he did. And he had a lot to report, too. And that was different, plus the fact that they remembered it consciously, and they reported it right afterwards. And the police did just an excellent job of investigating, which hardly ever happens.
Well, I think when you've got, sometimes you get certain cases, regardless of the type of phenomena that's involved. And we often look at authorities as being very sort of dismissive of people who see strange creatures or claim to have been abducted or seen a strange light in the sky that's acting weirdly, Irina. But Pascagoula is one of those that, do you think that was due to it being a kind of small town and people knew who Charles was and therefore they thought he's not really the kind of guy to try and pull a fast one here? And that's why it had a bit more sort of gumption in regards to the way that the authorities took it seriously. Whereas, as you say, most of us wouldn't think the first thing to do would be to call the police. We'd kind of sit at home wondering what the hell had just happened to us.
Yeah, I had a sighting several years ago and it took me a long time to report it. It was right before my book came out, though, and I was afraid it looked like I was putting a hoax out to sell my book or something. But I did report it immediately on Facebook and ask for other witnesses. I didn't exactly say UFO, though. I just said I saw something and looked around to see if there was anything else going on. It took me a long time, though, to report it. And I'm versed in all this reporting UFOs, and so I should be following the instructions to report immediately, but I didn't do that.
Well, I think that's a perfect example of it, that even for somebody like you, when it happened to you, you didn't do what you would you would think a witness should do. And I think that says a lot, really, doesn't it? Because it just shows you that even for somebody with your experience of the field and how it works and what we're supposed to do in certain situations. I mean, when I had mine, I didn't do it either. I just went, whoa, what's going on? And it just shows you, I think, it's all well and good thinking, right, this is what we need to do. But until it happens to you, you're not really sure how your brain's going to react, is it?
Yeah, and I mean, they were both reluctant because Parker didn't discuss it for 50 years. But Hickson immediately did that, and he was very brave to do that.
Well, some would say brave, but others would have said perhaps foolish in the circumstances sometimes, Irene, and not just for Charles, but in general, because there are countless situations. Do you think, obviously, with everything that's been going on in the US Congress over the last 2 or 3 years since these hearings began and the conversation seems to be a bit more serious about this, it seems as though the average person who has a sighting nowadays will be a bit more supportive. Do you feel that that's the situation, or do you think out in the country in certain states, people are still going to think that perhaps somebody's had a bit too much moonshine or doesn't understand what Venus actually is?
I think there's a lot less of that because we started on Pascagoula and nobody would have said anything. And now we're getting a bunch of people reporting who didn't say anything for 50 years. And I think the change in the government has made a difference because the government, and it's taught people to ridicule people's reports. And this is science. I mean, an observation is an observation, even if it makes no sense at all. But these are from perfectly normal, intelligent people. They're not drunks or, you know, anything like that. And not to say, I mean, even if you get drunk, that doesn't mean you see UFOs anyway. So I think it's doing a lot of good. I mean, the government isn't sticking its neck out very far, but they're at least acknowledging that people are seeing things that act like they're human made.
I think even for people like ourselves who have been interested and worked in this particular field for so long, I've noticed a real sort of sea change, even especially in the way that the media, I mean, the local media's still seems to be very sort of standoffish and ridicules things. But I think when you look at your major media outlets these days, they seem to be treating these stories with a little bit more sort of maturity, I think, now, Irina, whereas before they'd be so, you know, they'd mention the X-Files, they'd mention Little Green Men, tinfoil hats and things like that. And then I think a prime example of that, I think, was all these strange weather balloons that were flying all over North America last year that seemed to get everybody very excited for some reason about what was going on. And people were quite mature in the way that they were handling these reports on the media. They weren't sort of saying, oh, people are going crazy and all this. It seemed like it was being treated in a balanced manner. And I was quite taken aback. I was like, well, it's only taken them 72 years to catch up. Well done.
Yeah, I mean, before they'd always play that stupid music, da 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 da, and then say everybody. And now they don't play this stupid music for one thing, which really improves things. And they'll, in a serious manner, I mean, the national news has been reporting the congressional hearings and things like that in a perfectly serious manner, and no stupid music, which is really nice. And they don't say, well, everybody's crazy and all that.
Are you frustrated in regards to the thinness of the scope of these investigations and these hearings at the minute? Because the one thing I've been quite surprised about, and I think anybody who's got an interest in this particular topic will say straight away, Irina, is these only seem to be a very, very small proportion of what people are reporting, and it's only specific aspects of it. Anybody who knows much about ufology will talk about, as we were saying earlier, people who will see strange lights in the skies, people who will claim to have communications with them, people who claim to be abducted, people who claim to get messages from the other side, also people that vanish and then reappear in different places or a few days later. And yet these seem to be very sort of, well, we're dealing with this particular portion of it and everything else seems to be on the back burner. Do you think that that's because they want to start with a section that they think, well, these are credible witnesses because they're pilots and military personnel rather than just Bill who owns a farm in Arkansas?
Well, my next book is about that. The government only seems to process things that only something that's 20 miles away and on radar can exist. You can't get any closer than that. And my next book is going to be some, you know, saying that, yeah, maybe they get closer and perfectly sane people see things. But yeah, they're just sanitizing it and saying, well, maybe something that behaves strangely on radar might be something odd, or a jet plane pilot sees it or something like that. But I think a lot of people that see things are just as intelligent as the government bureaucrats that are saying it doesn't exist. So,
as well, I think that they've got to a point now where they've throughout the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, they would say to even extremely knowledgeable, scientifically minded people that they didn't understand what they were looking at. I think one of my favorite incidents in that regard is the gentleman that discovered Pluto. And I've forgotten his name.
Yeah.
But then 20 years later, he saw something and he was told he didn't know the night sky, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he saw like windows going flying across, and he discovered a Pluto. I mean, discovered a planet, and he had other witnesses. And, you know, they told him, no, you didn't see that. But
do you think it's because they know they can't get away with that kind of mothballing of experts nowadays? And especially, I think this is the other thing, when it comes to people who have a real interest in space and astrophysicists and the night sky, well, there's a lot of people who are very, very knowledgeable people who, yes, they don't have a degree in that particular subject, but they've spent countless hours looking at the night sky, and therefore they know it, one would say, like the back of their hands.
Yeah, and I think modern astronomy has changed a lot of things too, because it used to be that scientists know everything and there's no other life in the universe. We're the only intelligent life in the universe. Well, people are realizing how big the universe is, and they're also realizing that there's other planets all over the place. There may be more planets than there are stars, and that it would be pretty unusual statistically if we are the only life in the universe. I mean, I think more people are realizing that, and common sense or logic or something is making it more acceptable than it used to be. Because it, I mean, 20 years ago or so, they were saying, well, we're the only planets in the universe, which was a stupid thing to say because they couldn't tell whether there were any planets or not. And when they started looking, there were lots of other planets when they got the, you know, techniques so they could find planets.
Yes, I've always liked the comparison of that people say that often it's like putting a teaspoon into the sea, and if you don't pull a shark up, well, sharks don't exist. There's no sharks.
Yeah.
Because I think it's often sometimes one of the problems we've got is that occasionally people and certain scientists will make these incredibly broad sweeping statements about things. And like you say, we've no idea what's happening 100 million miles away from Earth. Really? We've no idea. It's only recently we've begun to see images of the far reaches of space, and even then, we can only see so far. I find it a remarkable statement for anybody to make that there's nothing out there, and we know everything that we need to know about what goes on in outer space, because that's the height of arrogance, isn't it?
Well, I always thought it was. I mean, they'd always, you know, roll out a scientist who would say, well, we're the only life in the universe, and then they'd say billions and billions and billions of miles that there's all these miles in between us, like the whole universe is on our level. With the whole universe, there might be, you know, it depends on the age of the universe. It could be as old as 26 billion years, and we've been here for 4 billion. So there could be way things much more advanced than us, that all those billions and billions of miles are nothing to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's one of those things. it's a constantly evolving discipline. And I think when we look back at what certain people used to make these cast iron statements, even as recently as 20 years ago, it's all beginning to look a bit silly now, isn't it?
Well, when they say we're the only intelligent life in the universe, well, I think we should check around and see. We may be stupid life compared to lots of life in the universe, too.
Yeah. Well, some would say we're not the most intelligent species on this planet, never mind anywhere else, Aaron.
Yeah.
I mean, as someone, as you say, that's become a very well-known researcher and author over the last few years, is it interesting now when you're writing about these subjects, and obviously with your latest book, Aliens and the Apocalypse, that you've got this kind of backdrop going on these days around you? It's almost as if when you're writing a book, you sometimes have to stop and catch up with the news just in case something's been released or we've got more intriguing evidence that seems to have come to light in certain cases, or perhaps even in these congressional hearings.
Yeah. One of my recent publications was in the MUFON Journal, and it was about disclosure. And I worked at Battelle, and Battelle did a study of UFOs. And this was back in the 1950s, and a whistleblower document where the whistleblower said that that Battelle was not ready to have people use their study, which they were doing for Blue Book, because it wasn't finished yet. Well, that was before the Robertson panel, and the Robertson panel was something the government got together and got all kinds of big wigs that knew were authorities in their field but didn't know anything about UFOs, and they all got together and said, well, there's no such thing as UFOs. Don't pay attention to it. And the press never made a ridicule anybody that said anything. Well, the whistleblower put the document out that the Air Force was secretly doing a study at Battelle to study UFOs. So that was just a total lie from the government. And I talk about that because I knew some of the people involved, but that was 1950s. And now they're finally just getting a little bit of saying something that, well, maybe something's going on, but I know they directly lied before, but maybe they were lying that they didn't know anything.
Well, there is that aspect to it. I'm often surprised when people say, oh, well, they've told us this and therefore it must be true. And even if you look at the history of official ufology, Irina, we know that they've consistently misled the public in regards to what they're doing, because they said Blue Book was closed down. And then all of a sudden, obviously, in the last 10 years, we discovered about ATIP. I find it very, very hard to believe that there was nothing going on between Blue Book shutting down and ATIP starting. I'm not having that. I just don't get it. It just doesn't make sense to me. I know, obviously, a lot of times in the 80s and 90s, a lot of people, if they phoned their local sheriff or the police or wherever, a lot of them seem to, this was one of the things that's always struck me when I've listened to some old interviews from the 80s and 90s, how many police departments in the States had the UFO reporting network telephone number to pass on to people, which I found a very strange thing, that it was so well known that they would just pass these people on at the time.
Yeah, and the government is ruining the data by having it set up so nobody can report anything, and saying that nothing happened, you're going to get ridiculed if you say anything. That's the way to really stamp out any knowledge. And we should be finding out more about this, because, you know, if somebody else is here, we need to know it.
Well, this is the thing. I know Leslie Keene's often said that the main reason people need to be concerned about this is that these are flight risks. At the end of the day, one would suggest, I mean, even though some people would say that there have been several cases of people having fatal encounters in the air with unidentified flying objects over the years, regardless of a couple of well-known cases, there's plenty of close shaves and people that claim to have hit them over the years. It would seem to be one of those things that, God willing, it never happens, but it's almost as if authorities want something bad to happen for it to finally put this to bed, that it is a security risk or a flight danger to people, because so far, according to official sources, none of that's happened. But anybody that knows enough about certain cases from the 50s, 60s, and especially into the 80s and 90s, there have been some really close calls with planes and military aircraft.
Yeah, I was just looking at the one that happened here, the coin helicopter. Do you remember that?
Yes, yes.
Well, that happened, the freeway I-70 was right through our place, and where that happened was not too far north, and I imagine the helicopter had probably gone right past my parents' place when it happened. But it was like the thing was coming on a collision course to the helicopter, and the helicopter dove. Well, then suddenly the helicopter was lifted when this thing put a beam on, and the people in the helicopter didn't know it. But it's like the thing beamed them up and saved them from crashing into the ground because they made a dive when they saw the object coming. And then it just stopped over and put a beam down, and suddenly they were up to 38,000 feet from almost being ready to crash.
That's always been one of my favorite encounters, primarily because he didn't give a damn. Because I think the first thing he did was report it to the press, so they couldn't stop him talking.
And he was respected, got promotions and everything else. I mean, he wasn't ridiculed. Of course, there were four of them, too, witnesses, and there were ground witnesses. And so they had, you know, trouble saying, well, it was your imagination, because four people saw it in the helicopter, plus people saw it on the ground.
Yeah, yeah. His interview, I think, just after it's happened, because it's near enough within a few, I don't know, 30 minutes, an hour of the event that he's being interviewed. And he's so bullish and confident. And you can tell he knows exactly what he's doing, Irina, because he knows this is going on the record. And there is no way that anybody can knock on his door anymore and tell him not to talk about it, because it's out there. The genie is out of the bottle now.
Yeah, those people at the report do a great service to everybody. And that's one of the best documented of any UFO encounters. Plus, it was a military helicopter, too.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's surprising as well, like you say, because often I know when we spoke about the boom that your mum heard, were your parents known for living on a UFO highway? Irina, there seems to have been a lot of strange incidents in their vicinity, isn't there? Because obviously you've got the coin incident, and then obviously the last time we spoke, we were talking about that mysterious boom that occurred over the area.
Yeah, that's something I'm still investigating too. I'm beginning to think it was called a sonic boom, and I'm beginning to think it was something else. I don't know what it was, but I remember my mother called and she said, "Did you hear that?" And she was 600 miles away, and I kept telling her it was crazy. And she kept on asking me, "Did you hear that?" And I kept thinking, "What's wrong with my mother?" And since then, I've interviewed a lot of people about the Pascagoula thing. That happened just about the same time as the Pascagoula abduction. And a lot of people seem to be confused or sort of not quite. They like their brain wasn't exactly normal or something, just like my mother. And so it was kind of weird.
It's almost like some kind of shock had taken effect. But I suppose when you experience something completely out of the ordinary, it does scramble the brain a little, doesn't it?
Well, it does scramble it, but sometimes if you see something like a UFO flying by close and it's levitating, well, that makes you think, boy, this is something. But sometimes it seems like people are more fearful or scrambled than they even ought to be. I was wondering about if there's metal effects that take place during some of these encounters, too.
I mean, I've been chuckling, as I mentioned to you before we started the interview proper. We've got a bit of a strange thing going on here in the UK over the last couple of weeks, where we've got, ironically, one of the most well-known locations for a UFO incident, allegedly, which is famously RAF Lakenheath and its fellow station RAF Mildenhall down here. And they seem to be being buzzed by strange drones, they're telling us. This seems to be one of those where the story broke and then the official response has come out afterwards. And it seems very strange that they're pulling everybody in to investigate what's going on, but they don't consider it to be a hostile threat, which I think is a bit of a a bit of a leap when you don't know what's going on to say, well, we don't think it's hostile, but we've no idea what's happening.
Yeah, that's totally illogical. And they say that all the time. Well, don't worry, nothing's happening, except that they don't know anything. That's back to my whistleblower thing from Mattel. I mean, they were telling everybody they're crazy, but they didn't know what was going on.
Hmm.
And they were lying.
Yes. I'll read you this statement because it's a prime example in double talk, I think, Irina, which is a US Air Forces in Europe spokesman, which is an organization I've never heard of, said, "We can confirm that there were sightings yesterday during nighttime hours and can only confirm that the number fluctuated and varied between the bases overnight." The spokesman added that since the first sighting on the 20th of November, there has been no impact to residents or infrastructure, and they have not been identified as hostile. However, they are still being monitored to ensure the safety and security of the installations and request individuals report them to the local police if seen.
There's been a bunch of drone sightings like that around here, and I could run out and get a report, but I don't have it right here. In the United States, of all kinds of drones, and you'd think they would find out what the drones are. You'd think they'd shoot one down and see what it was, see who made it, and that sort of thing, especially when they're over military bases. But instead, they just say, oh, you know, these are just drones. Well, somebody has to operate the drone. They have to, they should be able to pick up the signals from that and find out who's operating and where. And they ought to capture a drone and find out what's going on. And they don't do anything. They just say, well, this is drones. You're safe. And that's it.
Absolutely. I suspect if a member of the public broke into a military installation and decided to have a wander about, they wouldn't be treated so fairly.
No. So why are they letting drones do that? And I mean, drones can, I assume they can take pictures at night and all that too.
Hmm. Absolutely. Well, exactly. I mean, it could be something as bland as reconnaissance. But then this is the other thing. They're saying there's a large number of them. So I would suggest this is more than one person that's involved, if it is a person that's involved at all. So it all seems rather calm for essentially breaching military security. They seem very calm about it.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was talking to one of those people that worked at the guided missile site, at the ICBM site, that this UFO flew over and cut all the ICBM, everything, disarmed them or whatever for a while. And the government didn't seem to be interested at all, which, you know, that's our chief defense. If there's a war, you know, one of our chief defenses is the ICBMs. And you'd think if something floated over the site and cut the power so they couldn't be armed or anything, activated, you'd think the government would have an interest in that because they put billions and billions of dollars into all those things.
Absolutely. It's, you know, that alone would be enough, I would suggest, to send shivers down the defense secretary's spine, whoever and wherever they are, Irina, that if you have strange lights in the sky that knock out your missiles, I'm not sure how you can treat that very calmly and think, yeah, that's a bit weird. Not, well, suddenly we're exposed and we're weak and we have no way to defend ourselves.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that kind of, those parameters kind of lead us into your latest book, which, as I mentioned, is Aliens and the Apocalypse. I mean, what was the genesis in creating this book? Because whilst it's clearly involved in your previous work and the work that you're currently doing, it does seem a bit of a departure in regards to the fact that you've kind of peeled back the layers of hidden history for it, it would seem, as well as this ongoing sort of version of why people are being contacted, because there are these two strands of they're here to save us, they're here to finish us. And yet we only have to look at the world since the end of the Second World War and the birth of the modern UFO age, that they don't seem to have intervened in any of the numerous conflicts that have occurred ever since.
Well, one thing that activated me on that was the Pascagoula. And during Pascagoula, there was this big wave of UFOs, probably the biggest wave ever, with the sound and the abduction and everything else. Well, at that time, there was a war going on with Israel. There was a scandal in the government. There was just everything that was going on now. And there we were real close to a nuclear confrontation. I mean, they were on DEFCON 3, which they've only been there twice, and the other one was the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
So it was close to atomic war. And now it's like sort of like it's coming back. I mean, there's a war in Europe. There's scandals all over the place and everything you can think of, like 50 years later.
Mm.
And that was one thing. And the other thing is that we've always thought of the end of the human race or being destroyed or something external, like, you know, an asteroid hits or a volcano goes off or a plague or something like that, that we don't have any control over. But one of the most dangerous things now is us. I mean, we can destroy ourselves, and we're spending zillions of dollars doing that. And that seems pretty much insane. And so that was one thing I was writing about in the book, is that we're spending all this money and effort to destroy ourselves, which is stupid. And so I was saying in the book that one of the messages that we're getting from aliens, that people are receiving messages, they're not saying make bigger weapons and kill everybody. They're saying get along. And they're also, there's spiritual messages like that. But I was also saying that the appearance of the aliens, like right now we're in a conquistador type civilization where we think that we were created by men going out with spears and weapons and killing everything you can think of. And that's what created us. But when you look at the aliens, they're not like men in spacesuits or something. A lot of them look like women, and they're skinny little things. They're not, you know, big, dangerous men with weapons. And so I was saying that maybe they're sending us a message to be more cooperative instead of more hostile. And I was also saying, with presenting evidence in the book, that we weren't created by men going around, you know, spearing mammoths with sharpened stones, that we were created probably in a different way. And that was by being able to think in symbols. And I was saying maybe that's what created us instead of hostile men, and that the ability to think in symbols was probably done by women. And I was presenting evidence that they used to think groups of animals with a male in it was a male harem. But now they're finding out more about animals. And I mean, like, I photograph animals all the time in my yard, that most groups of animals are groups of females. The females are the leader and the members over time and all that. And the males aren't the leaders or anything else. They're temporary components of the groups. And that probably humans start out the same way as all the other mammals, with groups of females. And that's shown in the Ark, for example. We humans have been here for about 200,000 years, and most of the art up until only a few thousand years ago was pictures of females.
Mm.
And they think males did it, and that maybe we began with groups of females just like the other animals, and that's where we developed our ability to symbolize.
I think it is quite surprising sometimes when we look back at certain aspects and periods of history, that it's almost as if, like you say there, that things just seem to happen and nobody wants to really explain why. It's just, as you say, it's all this hunter-gatherer situation, and conflict and hunting is what's driven our evolution as a species. And yet we can see clear periods of time where that just wasn't going on. Yes, of course, people, communities and cultures would have to go to war, usually from invading forces more often than not. So there are always people wandering about trying to take what wasn't theirs. And yet you still see it. Egypt is a prime example of this, of a period of history where men and women could be as equally powerful at the head of the state, depending on their birthright and how they got there. There was none of that that you would see in other cultures, such as Rome or Greek, where it was predominantly men-led, but obviously women were held in importance and had major roles in those particular cultures. But the Egyptians seem to be the one that stands head and shoulders above everybody else in regards to that they weren't bothered whether you were a man or a woman. It was all down about the lineage, regardless.
Yeah, well, in animal groups, usually it's the females that form the group. They're the leaders and everything else. And I was saying that probably when humans started out, they started out the same way. And like the art and the pictures in caves and things like that, up until most of the time there's been people, these have been pictures of females. And that's probably where people developed the ability to think in symbols, because they were making art and statues and things like that. And if you can make a statue or draw a picture, you can describe something in a way. And that's probably where people developed our ability to think in symbols. And I think the ability to think in symbols is what distinguishes us from the other animals, not aggression and fighting and things like that.
Very much so. And I think it's quite telling, like you say, when you look in the animal kingdom. I mean, lionesses are renowned for their demanding behavior, shall we say, towards male lions. There's been many footage of their courting rituals caught on camera, which leaves many a male feeling a little jaded and tired just watching it, I think, Irina. Many people will say the worst thing you can come across in the woods is an angry mother bear rather than a male. You know, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. You can see in the animal kingdom, it does seem to be more of a matriarchy than anything else, doesn't it?
Well, I was saying that cooperative behavior probably is a lot more complex than aggressive. And I was just showing, for example, we have the opinion that of Darwin, that, you know, the origin of the species, that everything's a fight to the death, like the survival of the fittest. Once there was a big fight, and then the fittest survives, and then so on and so on. Well, I was saying that's probably not how evolution works, because if that was so, it'd just be one cells fighting each other. Instead, we have all kinds of organisms, such as us, of cells that get along fine together, and they would have to be able to cooperate and coordinate in order to make our cells or anything else that's, you know, made out of several cells. I mean, I think that's a stronger part of evolution than fighting.
Well, very much so, because that just seems to be a no-win situation. There's clearly had to have been some kind of calmness to our position on the planet, because otherwise, if all you do is spend time running about killing each other, eventually there's usually one result. And yet here we all are today, based on, as you say, 200,000 years worth of people moving around the world and setting up places and moving to some what would have been quite inhospitable at that particular period, but still were able to carve out a life for themselves that have enabled us to basically reach every corner of the planet, with the exception of Antarctica, really.
Yeah, well, I was using the example of the Tyrannosaurus and the bee. They both started out at the same time. The Tyrannosaurus was a big thing. It could stomp on a colony of bees and kill them and everything. It had big teeth and killed things. The bees took some flowers, but they gave back the flowers. And now Tyrannosaurus is long extinct, but there's bees. And I was saying that cooperation probably is a stronger way to get along, and also it's what that makes the ecosystem more complex, is to develop interactions that are cooperative, and then things grow together and improve rather than just spending all their time fighting.
Absolutely, because whilst you can look back in history and see that certain cultures, yes, they were very prepared to do whatever they needed to do to defend themselves or to take territories, but it wasn't in isolation. I know, when you think about certain cultures and what they did, whilst there may be conflict, there's always usually art or poetry or acting or writing going on at the same time. They don't work in isolation, these things. And I think sometimes it's a very naive way to look at our history to consider it purely being about conquest and killing. Whereas you can clearly see, as you refer to there, that there must have been cooperation going on from different states and different areas and different territories to share ideas, to share crops, to allow people the space to improve their ways of life without focusing purely on weaponry.
Yeah, and I think the life forms that get along better develop more complexity, and evolution has developed more complexity on Earth. I mean, most of the time, And, you know, life was here. It was just one cells. But in the more recent time, cells learn to work together and make complex organisms like us. And if they didn't, if they were still just fighting each other, they would never, there'd just be one cell still. There wouldn't be more complex life forms like this planet, like plants and animals.
Well, exactly. And I think this is, without it sounding like a cliche, there are so many examples throughout time of nature finding a way in incredible circumstances to get through. As you say, bees have been with us millions and millions of years and are still here, regardless of what certain pesticide companies would like, it would seem. And yet, as you say, they are such an insignificant creature on the size of things, but their place in Earth cannot be underestimated, because they're, whilst being small, they're still one of the most important creatures this planet has, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you killed all the microorganisms, everything else would be dead. They're the most successful of anything, but they also learn how to cooperate and get along together, which produced more advanced life forms.
Precisely. And I think you only have to look at some of the work that's gone on in the last, I don't know, 40 or 50 years in regards to parthenogenesis, Irina, and the fact that this is something that still seems to catch people out when they talk about the asexual reproducing abilities of certain species. I know that they're now beginning to think that birds can do it as well as lizards and insects, which it would seem to me that this is an area of scientific study that perhaps, I wouldn't say it's necessarily been overlooked, but as we were talking about people discovering things and making sweeping statements about the universe around us and our place in it, this seems to be one of those things that we don't know very much about it. We know it goes on. And yet, I don't know, it doesn't seem that there's a real appetite to find out just how common this is.
Yeah, well, all kinds of animal species can. I was saying one reason why there's conflict is in the males, and that's because just the females pass life from generation to generation. I mean, life is in the form of a cell, of cells. And the female passes a cell. All the males passes half the DNA, so that in many, many, many species, the female can reproduce with no male. But the males have to reproduce to a female. So the males are in competition with each other to get the females. And I don't think anybody ever realizes that there's vast numbers of animals and all through evolution where the females can reproduce quite well by themselves. And that's one of the reasons there's conflict in multicellular animals, is because the males fight each other for the females. And the female has to go to a lot of work to pass on life, because they have to get all the energy and everything to put into their eggs and all that, which the male doesn't have to do. All he has to do is manufacture a little bit of DNA, which doesn't survive on its own.
And so do you think that then is connected to what people have reported, as we were saying, that a lot of human-alien interaction, as you said, they're slender, they seem to be asexual? I mean, this is one of the things I think when people talk about things like the Greys, they always say that they it's almost as if they presume that they're male, even though you can't see any sort of sexual organs on them. They don't seem to have breasts or genitals or anything on display. They just seem to be very asexual. There doesn't seem to be anything that can tell you if they're male or female. And so do you think it's just the presumption that people think that most aliens are male? Or do you think it's that they're misinterpreting the way they look, because to our eyes, they don't look sexual, and therefore we can't work out whether they're male, female, or somewhere in between?
Well, they look like young females, actually, a lot of them. I was using the example of Roswell, and Roswell's first, the idea that UFOs are ships that have alien pilots came in. I mean, that was the first thing. And the moldings at Roswell show females pretty clearly. And a lot of, in our own culture, we see these conquistador males with their spears and everything. Well, that's not what the aliens look like. They look like skinny little females, actually. And I was saying that may be a method of communicating that our idea that we were formed by hostile people out killing isn't the way we evolved.
Would you suggest then that perhaps this is one of the indications of what's going on when we have reports of people claiming to have had a sperm taken, for example? Because as you've just explained there, the female has the cell that needs to be fertilized, essentially. The theory that these are females collecting what they require because they don't have that ability, or perhaps they may not have a male species or a male counterpart on wherever they're from. And this is one of the reasons. Or do you think this is just one of those weird quirks of the abduction theory? Because obviously there are women that have reported that they've had eggs taken as well, and phantom pregnancies and the like over the years.
Yeah, they're reporting both that. And I don't know. A lot of people are reporting that. I mean, women and men both. And so I suppose I should have a theory, but I don't.
I wasn't trying to catch you out.
You know, they'll have discussions with the aliens, and one I was working with here said, well, that the aliens are trying to breed things like us or other planets, or be like us and walk among us in disguise. But I just don't know.
I think sometimes this is the problem, because sometimes we can get so much data and so much personal interpretation or an abductee's interpretation of events, that sometimes perhaps the real reasons for what's going on is often skewed somewhat. Because I would suggest that if you're able to travel vast distances of outer space, seemingly avoiding all our detection systems, traveling at incredible speeds, stopping on the flip of a dime, going from one side of an area to the other in the blink of an eye, making no noise often, and yet people would suggest that they would struggle to invent some kind of cloaking device, even though we know their ships on occasion have allegedly been protected in some way, that they wouldn't have had something that would allow them, as you were saying there, that particular person said, to walk amongst us. Who's to say that they don't have the technology to just do that anyway? They might just be walking down every high street around the world. We just can't see them.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, I think they can be all over. There's a lot we don't see, like we don't see gravity, we don't see radio waves. The world is full of things we can't see and we don't understand. And they may be a part of that, and they can appear to us if they want to, or not appear to us. And they may be here all the time.
I suppose when you were pulling this together, when you were speaking to some experiencers and abductees, what was the general consensus? Because I think this is, as we've touched on, one of the things about the contactee movement that seems to have always been with us since the early days of the 50s and certain notorious individuals such as Adamski and the like, was that it was always this peace and love and let's get on and we all need to calm down and stop trying to hurt each other. And you would think if it was such an easily manipulative untruth, or people were just hoaxing all the time or putting their own personality into their alleged experiences, Irina, that the stories would change somewhat, or they would be more aggressive or whatever. But it still seems to be the same things when you hear certain people talking about their experiences, or we interview a group of people who claim to have had a message. It's always about the environment, about not hurting our planet, ourselves, and being more cooperative once again.
Yeah, I haven't really talked to anybody that said, you know, kill as many people as you possibly can, as fast as you can, which is what we're doing. I mean, we're making lots of weapons to do that. And the messages seem to be different and not like us. Our present culture of being so aggressive, it may be that we have to learn that on our own, that they don't come in and make us peaceful. We have to figure out how to do that.
I suppose when you were pulling the book together, was there any aspect of it that really surprised you, or something that you were thought, why did I not know this? How is this not more well known? Or were you quite, as someone I would consider extremely scholarly, Irina. Were there things that you came across that completely shook the foundations of what you thought you knew?
Yeah, the advantage of cooperative behavior. I mean, we now have all our authorities as male who are saying it's all, everything was created by competition, and that's due to Charles Darwin. People seem to worship him. Well, I think there's a whole lot of reason to think that that's not true, because things, competition's fine if you just want to stay the same. But if you want to evolve, complexity is having more different things interacting, and you get complexity by cooperation. And I think that was like a revelation to me, because I'd always, you know, I'd taken all these courses. I have a PhD from a vet school and all that, where Charles Darwin is just worshipped. And I think those ideas aren't right, because I think he was saying survival of the fittest, and you have to have two things competing and then one winning. Well, maybe if they develop together and learn how to get along peacefully, that then they can combine their two abilities and go on and improve a lot more. And so I think that cooperation is more important than competition. That was my revolution as I went through and thought about that.
Well, exactly. I think you only have to look at how the conversation has changed in regards to how people viewed what happened to Neanderthals 30, 40 years ago compared to what we now know. Because that was always that very similar thing, like you say, Darwin's survival of the fittest, and it was basically Homo sapiens against Neanderthals, and we were a bit cleverer, and we could use fire, and we were better at tool making, and therefore we just wiped them out because they couldn't compete with us. And yet now we know that there are people around the world who have Neanderthal DNA in them, and there's only one way you get that, and that's not by killing people.
Yeah. And you don't know how, I mean, most people probably in the world are part Neanderthal or variations of that. So we're not really Homo sapiens. We have ancestors from both types that learned how to get together, and that may have made us better.
Absolutely. Well, if anything, it's a prime example of what you're saying there about cooperation, because otherwise, if it was survival of the fittest, there wouldn't be any of their DNA in us at all. And one would suggest that as we continue to learn more about our ancestors, there's probably going to be other strands of DNA turn up that somebody's going to go, holy hell, I think I've made an earth-shattering discovery here. Because it wouldn't surprise me if 10 years down the line we discover that somebody's got Florensis DNA in them, Irina. Why would it only been the Neanderthals? If we were cohabiting with other species of a similar ilk to ourselves, why would they die out or be wiped out and not the Neanderthals? I find that hard to believe, that they were okay, but everybody else was eradicated. That makes even less sense to me now.
Well, a lot of people have Denisovian DNA, mainly in Asia, but there's quite a few people with that.
So it shows that we have parallel cooperations going on in different parts of the world at the same time.
Yeah, the Neanderthals are just our ancestors, just like we used to be people. They're our, you know, like great, 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 great grandparents.
Very much so. So has it changed the way you view the world, writing this book, in regards to it? Because when I read it, I was really taken aback by some of the information included in it, some of the theories that you've spoken with. I mean, this is not you just deciding you're going to write a book and read a few things. You have liaised with some of the most educated scholars in their particular fields dealing with certain sections of this particular book, haven't you?
Yeah, I've talked to a number of people that worked with apes, and like the bonobos are probably more like us than any other apes, and they are very peaceful and matriarchal. And I think with a lot of other animals that are presented as being vicious and everything else, that actually they're fairly peaceful. Not, I mean, we're more aggressive a lot of the other ones.
Absolutely. And it's, well, we only have to look at the way certain animals are extremely adept at keeping out of our way most of the time. And one would suggest that this has to be learnt, I would put forward, rather than some of those incredible things that sometimes you look at the animal kingdom and it absolutely baffles my mind what certain creatures out there can do. Salmon are a prime example of, you know, salmon are born, they swim off, and then they know, as almost by magic, they know how to, where to go and where to come back to. And I just, you think, well, have they got a map? I mean, is this muscle memory? Is this something that is passed down genetically to them? And then they're the best example I can think of. But there are clearly numerous species around the world who have these kind of inherent behaviours. Turtles are another one, that they will return to certain beaches to lay their eggs and then everybody just swims off. That we can see that they seem to have taught behaviour. And yet we often put forward the ideas that most animal species lack the intelligence to do such things or even cooperate with other species even. But we keep finding these examples and they're getting more and more common, aren't they?
Yes, I was very impressed with the apes I saw, because they can do just about what people do. They think and they can communicate using computers and things like that. But like, the idea that everything fights. Well, like, my yard is lots of times full of deer, and most of the time we get along just fine. But in the fall, the males fight each other. But if they went according to Darwin's evolution, they'd have fights to the death, and one of them would kill the other one. And then somehow Darwin would say, well, the winner would have, you know, pass on its genetics. Well, actually, like, I see deers all the time, the males come together. Lots of times they were kind of bow or shake heads. If they don't feel like fighting, they leave. If they feel like fighting, sometimes they fight. And like, there may be a bigger one and a young guy. And the young guy will come up and ask for a fight. Well, they don't kill each other. They just, you know, strut around with their fighting and show who's, you know, the strongest. And then the weakest one leaves, and then two or three years later, it may be a big deer, and it may be tossing around, you know, the next generation, but they don't kill each other or anything. They just come into their peak. And the idea that Darwin didn't understand anything about reproduction, because only the female can pass her own DNA to the next generation when they reproduce without a male. The male always has to reproduce the female. And so even if he's the big winner, the fighter, he doesn't necessarily pass his DNA to the next generation. He has to find a female, females who's interested in him and mate. And even then, the female has different DNA. And so he's not going to, he may pass some things on, but maybe not too. And Darwin didn't seem to know that. He just said, you know, there's these fights among the males, and then the next generation is composed of the winners of the fight. So I don't think that's true at all.
Well, I think as well, because it was such a limited, even though you look back at Darwin's work, and it was quite an undertaking. But in the scope of things in the modern era, it was quite a limited survey, really, that, as you say, he didn't spend enough time to watch creatures' real behaviours. He tended to sort of get snapshots of behavior and therefore base a lot of his work on, like you say, the accounts and encounters he was witness to.
Yeah, and he's saying everything's fighting. Well, like, then saying, well, the males fight and therefore their heredity goes down. Well, that's not true at all, because the males may fight, but they're fighting each other for females, and everybody leaves out what the females do. And that's probably a lot more important to their survival than the male fighting. I mean, the females have to go through the pregnancy, the birth, and often raise the young. And that's a much more complicated time-consumer thing than just males fighting. And that's why the males are fighting each other for the females. And they never say that. They always just say, well, the males fight, and that's the end of it. Well, they're fighting for the females, and they never seem to realize that either, and they never seem to realize that the females have a whole lot to do with their survival. It's not through fighting, it's through helping the next generation.
Exactly, because that, like you say, that's all well and good. You've got two animals having a fight because they want to catch somebody's eye. But
yeah,
it's the female that's the key thing here. That's the prize. And if it wasn't, if it was as simplistic as that, why do they bother fighting in the first place? Why don't they just take their choice of the females then? There doesn't seem to be, the reason for them fighting doesn't seem to be winning a prize, because if they were strong enough and proved themselves to be the dominant male in that kind of encounter arena, they wouldn't need to fight, surely, because everybody would know who they, that, you know, the position of that animal or that person in that particular relationship or that particular herd or flock or whatever. You would know who the dominant male would be, and therefore people would suggest, well, why doesn't he just take his pick of the female? There has to be some connection with that behavior and the opportunity to copulate, surely. You can't put the fighting on its own and think, oh, well, they'll just wait until they've done. That makes no sense.
Yeah, and the female has a lot more to do with the survival of the young than the male fighting, because the female can mate with anybody, and there's maybe different combinations of DNA. It doesn't, the biggest male doesn't necessarily pass on the best DNA anyway.
Mm, yeah, precisely. Absolutely. It's no guarantee, is it? You don't know what behaviors you may inherit in that child of whatever species it is. I suppose then, through your journey in looking back through our history and uncovering the amount of cooperation that must have gone on for us to be here today, has that changed how you view the topic of aliens and the messages that they're sharing with people, or have you always had an opinion on what the reasons were, and this has just solidified it with the research you've done pulling this book together?
I guess I didn't pay as much attention to it, and then somehow I just realized that the aliens usually are giving messages of peace, and they're not, you know, demonstrating aggression and fighting. I mean, I don't know anything about what they're really like, but it's like they're not really giving that, showing off weapons and things. I mean, I don't know if they're peaceful or not, but I think it's like maybe we're supposed to figure out how to get along on our own. And I was just saying that I think our opinion of how we developed is incorrect, and that we probably developed through peace and maybe that through cooperation, and that maybe we're supposed to learn how to develop in different ways, that maybe that is some of the communication that possibly comes from aliens. It may come from our own common sense, but it seems like a lot of people are reporting that there's going to be a big turmoil, and then maybe we'll learn how to do things better or something.
One can only hope, Irina. One can only hope. I mean, I have to say, when I was reading the book, it there was a lot of it that kind of took me back. I mean, I'm quite aware of the certain airbrushings of history that have gone on throughout the ancient world and even into the modern era, where people will ignore things if it contradicts the theories that they're trying to put forward or whatever. And you see this time and again, and things get released or people, things get uncovered, and we look at things in a completely different way. I suppose, has it changed your view of the world when you've spoken with these people and shared their knowledge in the book? Or would you suggest that you've always had that kind of feeling anyway, as you say, as an educated woman, that you've always been aware of the misinformation that's often put forward as academic history?
Yeah. When I was younger, I just swallowed everything that anybody said. But as I look into things in a lot more detail, well, I think there's a whole lot of things that are incorrect in what is being taught.
Well, it's an incredible book, I have to say. It's eye-opening, it's interesting, it's thought-provoking. It's just what anybody would need, really, when we consider the bigger questions in regards to why are we having these visitations? Why are people having these experiences? And so for you, when you look back at what this book is and you look at your work going forwards, has it changed your outlook in regards to how you're going to tackle your next subject? Because obviously you're a very prolific author who tends to sort of uncover some marvelous gems of information, or you sort the data out for us that can enable us to see far clearer in regards to certain events. For you, has it changed your ability to decipher the message, as it were?
Well, I think the message maybe I'm getting from other people or aliens or something is that I think what we've been taught as our history is not correct. I think that cooperation goes a lot farther than competition or fighting. And I don't think anybody realizes that everybody's been taught that, well, what you do is fight and the biggest one wins and all that. Well, I think life is a cooperative affair where there's, in order just to have the human body, you have all these different cells cooperating. And if they were fighting, we'd be falling apart. And I think nobody's discussing the importance of cooperation. They're always discussing competition. And I think evolution, so far as changing into more complex beings, has to do with cooperation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, before I let you leave, what's next for you, Irene? What's your next project? Can you tease us with anything? Can you tantalize us with your next project? Because I'm a big fan of your work and I love reading your books because I always learn things when I read your work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there's a lot more information that's come out about Pascagoula, and I'm writing about that it was part of a very widespread event. And I was also writing about that there are mental effects from the what you'd call UAP, and that people ought to pay attention to that too. I mean, they're paying attention to physical things, like people are writing books about how physical harm comes to people and things like that. But nobody's paying attention to the fact that there's mental effects too. And I think that is something that people should pay attention to just as much as physical and, you know, flights over missile silos and things like that. That people, I mean, a lot of people, when they're the abductees say that something's been implanting in their brain. Well, I think that's something important, that if something is implanted in their brain that, you know, like hypnotic suggestions to do something, you should know about it.
Very much so. You would hope.
Yeah.
So when's the next book due for our enjoyment to be released into the wild, as it were?
I'm still working on it. I hope it's released. I hope I get finished. There's a lot more data, too, though, of more interviews with people that have had experiences and that sort of thing. Mm. There were a lot around Pascagoula. But I've even found one that had sort of that type of experience here, surprisingly enough, in Ohio. And there was a flap in Ohio, too.
Yes, yes. I think there are flaps in most states if people can be bothered to unpick them and look for them properly, Irina. And it's, I think that, as we've mentioned several times, Pascagoula is a prime example of, if you keep digging, you never know what treasures you'll uncover eventually.
And we're discovering a lot of them, which is pretty amazing. I mean, Philip Mantle just keeps at it and at it and at it. And he's really uncovering all kinds of things.
He's got a time machine and he's able to find these documents because he can travel back and tell us where they are. And that's his secret.
Maybe that's how he's doing it.
Oh, well, I wish you the best of luck with that project. I can't wait for it. So thank you as always. Where can everybody follow you online and find your previous books, as well as Aliens and the Apocalypse, please?
All my books are on Amazon.com, and also I have a website, irenascott.com, and it shows my books and talks and podcasts and things like that, and newspaper articles and all that, too. They can just go to irenascott.com and click on a book, and it immediately goes to Amazon, and they can order it.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links, as always, into the show notes for everybody to track you down. And I just want to say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you for fitting me in. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. And I hope, and no, it won't be 3 years till we speak again, You take care and thank you again.
Thank you very much. It's great to hear you, and your podcasts are super.